From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Joe Biden makes his pitch for the presidency tonight, the final night of the 2020 Democratic National Convention. This is the first time out of three runs for the White House that Biden has ever won the party's nomination. So let's listen to a moment from his first presidential campaign back in 1987.
We are in a position as a nation and as a generation to make a significant contribution to making things better for ourselves and for our people, and also for what in fact is true, the United States, which is the last best hope for free women and men throughout the world.
Biden was 44 then, he's 77 now, and he's pitching himself as the last best hope for a nation he believes needs rescuing from the Trump presidency. Biden's personal story is central to that mission, so this hour on Point, we're going to talk about some of the lesser-known moments from his long political life. And we'll start today in Media, Pennsylvania, with Phil Friedman. Phil is news director of the News Journal and DelawareOnline.com. He also edited the book Joe's Journey, Biden's Rise to Vice President. Phil Friedman, welcome to On Point.
Thanks. How are you?
Doing well. So given how long that you've known Joe Biden and Joe Biden in Delaware, what do you expect him, or what do you think he will say tonight as he presents himself as the Democratic nominee to the American people?
I think it's a lot of undoing what the current president has done. I think that's been the message through the primary and even before the primary when he was making us wait to see if he was going to run. I think the way he tells that message will, he's had so many, I guess a lot of people do, but he's had so many sort of interesting events in his life, you know, and interesting might not be the right word, but from his wife and daughter being killed, his son dying, you know, when he ran in 87 and had the plagiarism allegations. There's so many things that he's overcome to get here. We were talking with one of the other editors. I said, I know you guys aren't old enough to remember this, but imagine dropping out of a presidential race because of a plagiarism accusation and then staying in the Senate for another 20 years in a leadership post and becoming vice president. That's not easy to do, you know? So I think he's an expert at overcoming things. And a lot of that were things that happened in his childhood that he overcame, and it's the person he portrays himself to be, and I think there'll be a lot of that feeling in his speech tonight.
Uh-huh. Well, you know what? Let's sort of travel back through the magic of radio, back to 1972, and we've got some tape here of then 29-year-old Joe Biden, who was a member of the Newcastle, Delaware City Council at the time, and this is in his run for the U.S. Senate. And here is a Biden radio ad from that campaign.
I'm Joe Biden, and I'm a candidate for the United States Senate. I've asked my staff to tape record some statements people made when I campaigned at Price's Corner Shopping Mall.
Do you believe politicians when they tell you something in an election year?
No.
Most of the time, no.
No comment. That's what we've come to. Politicians have done such a job on the people that the people don't believe them anymore. And I'd like a shot at changing that.
It's Joe Biden in 1972. So, Phil, tell us about Biden's entrance into the sort of the national level political stage. What was he offering to the people of Delaware back then that that got him that seat in the Senate?
He won that seat against Caleb Boggs, who was a Republican, had been in the seat, I think, two terms already, was a huge favorite. And Biden was, I think he said 29, I think that's right. I mean, and Newcastle County Council is not like, you know, Philadelphia City Council or something like that. It's a very, it's not the traditional stepping stone. He won that election. I had never heard that radio ad. It was great, by the way. He won that election by knocking on probably every door in Delaware. that's a stretch. But he was a huge underdog. The way that he won the race was knocking on doors, making personal connections with people, and sort of how that radio ad goes to people and ask them their opinion. He would talk to them, he would listen, and then he'd go to the next door. And we've written hundreds of stories at the News Journal about him, and it seems like everybody in Delaware has a story of a personal interaction with Biden at some point, whether it was at a gas station or a hamburger joint or something, that everybody seems to know him. And I think that's where that I guess you call it political charisma. That's how we got elected. And at the time, Delaware was a very Republican-heavy state. Republicans held most of the major offices and leadership posts. And when he won that Senate race in 72, it was a huge upset, and it really swung the state around. Till now, there's very few Republicans in any positions of power in the state. And it's been that way for probably 20 or 30 years. I'm sorry.
Oh, so no, it's okay. I just wanted to, so just to be clear, you said that in at least in part, Biden's win helped swing the state around. Is that what you said?
Yeah, I don't think anybody would dispute the fact that him winning that Senate seat and ousting a Republican who was part of the Republican machine in Delaware at that time, I think, I don't know if it opened people's eyes. It was 1972. Even I wasn't paying attention to politics then. I don't know. but it's credited with starting the sort of tidal wave that turned the state Democratic politically.
Yeah. Well, I want to just get, there's a story I'd love to hear you tell. I'm not actually sure if it's your outlet who reported it, but it's a really telling story about how that connection, we're going to hear that word a lot this hour, that Biden just strives, and definitely at that time was striving to make. It's about a woman who had died in Wilmington in her 80s or 90s, and Biden, did he go to her funeral, or there's a story there?
Yeah, I came across it a couple months ago. It actually happened 16 or 18 years ago, and there's a rabbi, his name is Michael Beals. He had just come to Delaware. It was one of his first things, one of his first weeks or months, I don't know. He wrote this story on, I think I read it on medium.com. But there was a woman who was older. I think her age was 70s or 80s, like you said. And she had passed away. She was not well off. She didn't have a lot of family. And he wrote about how in the Jewish tradition, when somebody dies, they mourn at somebody's house. And a couple times a day, they do these prayers for the dead. And they need, my mother will kill me for not knowing this, I think 10 people to do the prayer. And her apartment was so small, they had to go downstairs into the apartments, where the washing machines and dryers were, to hold this service. And the rabbi's telling the story that, it's him and 10 people reciting this prayer. It takes like 10 or 15 minutes to do. And near the very end of it, Joe Biden walks in the back. Doesn't say anything, just sort of comes in and stands there. And when the prayer ends, the rabbi first was making sure he wasn't seeing things, walked over and introduced himself and said to Biden, "What are you doing here?" And Biden said that when he first ran for Senate in 1972, the woman had contributed $18 to his campaign. And, $18 is in Jewish, whatever, is a lucky number. She didn't have a lot of money, but every time he ran for Senate, she would send in $18. And I don't know how Biden knew that, because I'm sure a lot of politicians don't know the names and addresses of people. But he said, "She gave to me every time. She was there for me. I wanted to be there for her." And this was never anything that was reported. It was not there was no press release from his office saying, hey, go to this apartment building and watch this neat thing Joe Biden did. It happened, and it took 18 years till anybody knew about it. And whether you like him or not, whether it was Joe Biden or Donald Trump, I mean, that story, to me, tells a lot about a person. Yeah. Doesn't mean should vote for him, but I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, it's okay, Phil. But hang on for a second, because I want to bring in Jack Beatty. He is On Point's news analyst with us from Hanover, New Hampshire. Hi there, Jack.
Hello, Magda.
So I wanted to bring you in, Jack. We'll have you with us for the rest of the hour, but just reflect with us on the story that Phil told us, because, you know, it's quite remarkable, actually. And at the same time, making that kind of personal connection as a senator from a small state, is different than trying to make that kind of personal connection with a nation as a presidential nominee. So do you think Biden could do that tonight?
Well, he's going to try to. He won't be able to see the audience. And for him, throughout his career, watching people, seeing the moment of the connect when he reaches them, that's been so important to him. So he'll have to posit them. But, you know, the thing about Joe Biden, at least reading his biography in Richard Ben Kramer's What It Takes, classic book on the 88 campaign, he actually managed to combine empathy and canniness in a crucial moment in that 1972 campaign. And I'll tell you what it is after the break.
Okay, well, Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst, hang on here for a second. Phil Friedman, news director of the News Journal and DelawareOnline.com and editor of the book Joe's Journey, Biden's Rise to Vice President. Phil, thank you so very much for getting us started on some wonderful anecdotes about Joe Biden in Delaware. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we're taking a look at some of the lesser-known moments in Joe Biden's long political biography. Of course, tonight, he formally accepts the nomination from the Democratic Party as their nominee for President of the United States. And Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst, is with us. And Jack, before the break, you were about to tell us something from Richard Ben Kramer's book about Joe Biden's first presidential run back in 1987. So pick up where you left off, Jack.
Well, actually, before that, to this 1972 that you were just talking about. And it was a moment that illustrated that sometimes empathy can pay off, and sometimes it's shrewd. He was in a debate. He was 29. He was debating the 63-year-old incumbent Senator Boggs. And the senator was asked a question in this debate about some arcane treaty, and he stumbled around. He didn't seem to know what he was talking about. Joe knew the answer. He had been prepped, but he was 29. The other guy was 63. He knew that if he showed him up, it would look awful bad, especially to senior citizens, to have this young whippersnapper putting Cale Boggs in his place. So when they asked Joe, do you know what we're talking about? Do you have an answer? Joe said, I don't know that one either. It was brilliant. He won the debate by through an act of shrewd empathy. He didn't show up Cale Boggs. And he knew the answer and protected himself from the charge of being a young punk. It was very well done.
Well, Jack, hang on here for a moment, because I want to bring into the conversation now Jennifer Senior of the New York Times. She's an op-ed columnist there. We have a link to her recent op-ed headlined Meet Young Joe Biden, the Wild Stallion. That link is at onpointradio.org. Jennifer, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
So you wrote about rereading Richard Ben Cramer's book about the 88 presidential election. And of course, Biden was running at that time as in 1987. Why was that moment and that book in particular so eye-opening again to you about Joe Biden?
Oh my God, so many reasons. Let me start by telling you one thing, the first thing that was eye-opening. He never even made it to 1988. He flamed out in 87. It was so brief. People forget this. Several things. First of all, I think that, you know, for a whole generation, which does not include me, I'm sad to say, I think a whole generation looks at Biden and only sees him as somebody who's old, right? And so I would recommend anyone who doesn't have any image of even a middle-aged Joe Biden to go back and to look at this book, because it's a little bit, as I said in my column or my longer essay, it's a little bit like stumbling on old pictures of Betty White, right? Like you're just suddenly seeing someone. It doesn't even occur to you that, you know, what they might look like or be like in their prime. But to answer your question, I was interested, first of all, in the continuities of his personality, and it's all there. You know, even back then, he was irrepressible. He was charming. He had these great gusts of temper. He was very decent. He was sloppy. He was, you know, all the things that you think of now. But what I was most interested in seeing was the following thing. Even back then, even then, he did not have a vision, he didn't have some kind of revolutionary idea about what he wanted to be president for. And this drove his advisors bananas. It made them really crazy. The only thing he knew for sure is exactly what Jack was just describing. And, you know, was this ability to connect with people. He knew the bedrock of his conviction was that he was a decent man and that character and like his ability to identify would see him through this thing. And it was insufficient. It wasn't enough. I mean, he couldn't marry that with some larger vision back then. So even, you know, people would say to him, why weren't you more active during the Vietnam War? And he would say, I was married. I was square. I didn't do the marching thing. I wore sport coats to, you know, to class, to law school, you know. So that was what was fascinating to me. We think of this as a product of age, that he's not revolutionary and visionary and all these things because he's old, you know, because he's just sort of aged out of thinking that way. He wasn't like that in 1987. He was never like that.
Well, of course, the interesting thing now is that, as we've been seeing all this week in the Democratic National Convention, even though there is very, you know, through the primaries, we felt that very revolutionary fervor from the progressive wing of the party, the DNC this week is putting, you know, Joe Biden's lack of revolutionary fervor, that sort of basic fundamental decency, the decency itself as being revolutionary in the face of of a Trump presidency. So Jack, I mean, do you think they're successfully pulling that off, that message?
Well, it certainly is their message. And, you know, what does David Axelrod say, that in presidential elections, people look for replicas or remedies? You know, do you want the replica of the president who's in office, or do you want the remedy to him? Joe is running as the remedy, and you couldn't be more different from Donald Trump, his middle-class roots as against Trump's gilded childhood, his hard-scrabble sort of background as against everything handed to Trump, and his life of suffering and tragedy, and on the other side, love, two very successful marriages, loving children. And none of that seems to be part of Trump's background. So it couldn't be more different.
Well, Jennifer, let me just switch gears a little bit, because you covered Biden also as when you were a reporter, right, on Capitol Hill for a while. Can you tell us what that was like? How quickly did you realize sort of that voluble voluble, almost even reckless, gaffe-prone Biden was possibly a sort of repertorial gold for you.
Yeah, irrepressible. Yeah, well, so Richard Ben Cramer is very funny about this, right? He has, so the headline for my story is the fact that his, it's a quote, it's partially a quote from Ben Cramer's book, which is that he was like a young stallion who had never felt the bridle. And that he was a, what was the other thing they said? An unguided missile. Those were the favorite things they said about him. This is great for a reporter. So I was, in 1994, I was one of the kids starting the, who started the publication, The Hill. It was a brand new publication at the time, The Hill newspaper. And, you know, we didn't know what we were doing. We were young. We were, no one was taking us seriously. Biden is a really good guy, as it has been said before. He really was in this sense. I mean, he looked at all of us and we were young and he probably thought, look, I was once a 29-year-old who thought I knew what I was doing. You know, I was 24, 25 at the time. And he treated us, first of all, as if we were going to be people one day. Also, he just, right, this thing about him being kind of almost verbally incontinent, I mean, it was amazing. You would walk up to him and he would start to talk and it was almost like a balloon that had let the air out and it was just whipping around suddenly above your head. There was all this pent up speech in him. And some of it was really useful. You know, some of it was great. And he became a person who also, I think this is important. If you wanted to know the status of a bill, like, is this thing going to pass? You had a better chance of getting an honest answer from him than from other people. And my theory about that has always been sort of the same as what it was for the guys who were veterans. They had seen so much worse that they didn't much see the point in lying about that small stuff like that, comparatively speaking. So you'd get a more honest answer from him sometimes.
Huh. Well, you know, I want to talk more about the moments in his legislative career that deserve attention, but we should spend a second talking about what deep sixed that first presidential run in 1987, because as Jennifer, as you noted, he didn't even make it to 88. And that's because this happened in a Democratic debate at the Iowa State Fair in August of 87. Biden said this.
And I started thinking as I was coming over here, why is it that Joe Biden is the first in his family ever to go to a university? Why is it that my wife, who's sitting out there in the audience, is the first in her family to ever go to college? Is it because our fathers and mothers were not bright? Is it because I'm the first Biden in 1,000 generations to get a college and a graduate degree that I was smarter than the rest? Those same people who read poetry and wrote poetry and taught me how to sing verse.
So that's what Joe Biden said in August of 87 at a Democratic debate. And to some very particular sensitive ears, it sounded familiar because Biden had taken it from a speech given by Neil Kinnock, who was the leader of the British Labour Party. And here is a bit of Neil Kinnock's original political broadcast.
Why am I the first Kinnock in 1,000 generations to be able to get the university? Why is Gladys the first woman in her family in 1,000 generations to be able to get the university? Was it because all our predecessors were thick? Did they lack talent? Those people who could sing and play and recite and write poetry.
That's the British Labour Party leader Neil Kinnock's original speech. Now, Jack Beattie, plagiarism, quite frankly, while bad even today, it seems like such a minor offense in comparison to the current political climate. But that was enough to push Biden out of the race. What happened?
Yes. Well, of course, he wasn't just borrowing the words. He was borrowing the life. You know, he said, Joe went on and said, my ancestors who worked in the coal mines of northeast Pennsylvania, his father was a used car salesman. What's this north coal mines? In other words, he was borrowing Kinnock's life. And, you know, often Joe Biden says things as if they haven't been mediated through his mind. He just says them and then he leaves meaning out. And this was one of those cases. He was exhausted. They had to come up with a close for the speech. He started to repeat it, and he essentially identified with Kinnock. But it was emblematic. It came out that there had been a plagiarism issue in law school. It came out that he had quoted Robert Kennedy rather promiscuously and not given credit. It came out that he had elaborated, to use a euphemism, about his academic life, career. He was not a good student. He did not graduate with 3 degrees. He did not get a full academic scholarship to law school. Why did he do these things? What was going on with him that he had to invent and as it were, be someone else? Why wasn't being Joe Biden enough? And he was just caught out with that. And when the Dukakis campaign essentially framed that speech, the Kinnock speech, juxtaposed it on a tape with Biden's speech, and sent it to Maureen Dowd at the New York Times, it was on the front page, and the rest was history.
So, Jennifer, it made his presidential bid in 87 history, consigned it to the dustbin, as the Brits might say. But he's obviously, Biden continued on with a long Senate career. It didn't sideline him as a politician completely. So he survived that. I mean, what does that say?
Well, some of it is that, you know, the Senate is one of these places where being able to connect is highly, highly useful, particularly back when he started there. And bipartisanship was actually much more common because there were still Northeastern liberal Republicans and there were Southern Democrats who were quite conservative. So you needed all this kind of cross-party cooperation. You know, this is how, I mean, this was before Biden's time, but it's how this, you know, the Civil Rights, you know, Act got passed. I mean, you know, Everett Dirksen played a big part in this, the Republican leader. I mean, it's useful to be a schmoozer and a glad hander and a talker like he is in the Senate. You can have a very good career there if you're personable. He still, you know, throughout his Senate career was overexcitable and prone to exaggeration. I don't think those qualities, you know, I'm sure they've diminished over time, but I mean, he's still kind of like this. I don't think that he's as uncareful anymore. And I don't think that one of the theories that Ben Cramer had about that moment was that he was so desperate to find anything to connect with people because it wasn't working on the national level, was that he just started stealing people's words, which is, you know, granted kind of a partisan view of him. It's an affectionate view of him and the most charitable one conceivable, but not out of the question, I suppose. Anyway, my answer as to why he could keep going in the Senate is that, you know, I mean, he was smart, he worked hard, he was diligent, and he was personable. You know, those are good qualities for the Senate.
As you've sort of been refamiliarizing yourself with parts of Biden's political history, are there any other surprising stories that have resurfaced in your mind?
Oh gosh, let me see. There was one. Oh, and I had it and. Oh God, Jack, can you help me out here? It comes back to me, the part that there was something that I had sitting in the cutting
Kitty,
room.
Kitty, did you want to talk about
yes,
Kitty Kelly?
Kitty Kelly, oh yes. Oh my God, this interview that he did with her in the Washingtonian, Kitty Kelly, it was bananas. He did this interview where he was this divinely eligible bachelor for a while, right? Because he shows up in Washington. He's got this totally tragic story attached to him. His wife and baby daughter die right around Christmas, right before he's sworn in. He is sworn in his son's hospital room. He shows up and everyone in the universe wants to take him to dinner. The Kennedys are in hot pursuit of him. He's this hot ticket because he's this young, eligible bachelor. And what was remarkable was reading it and seeing, first of all, you're marveling as a reporter at the kind of access that she got, this full saturation access, but also that he is saying things to her that are at once utterly cringeworthy by today's standards. Like he's walking over and showing her a picture of his wife in a bikini and saying, look, isn't she better looking than a Playboy bunny? I mean, this is his, you know, he's a widower now, right? So that, but also he's saying things that are really kind of soul-searching and reflective. Like, I know why I'm an attractive dinner candidate. You know, it's because I've suffered a tragedy. And, you know, I want to resist that. I'm not here for that. I'm here to do the work. It was very weirdly moving and a little creepy, is what I'd say.
Well, Jennifer Senior, New York Times op-ed columnist, and her recent column was called Meet Young Joe Biden, the Wild Stallion. We have a link to that at onpointradio.org. Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Jack, when we come back, there's another moment from the late 80s that I want to touch on with you. So hang in there. We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are taking a look at a couple of particular moments in the political life of Joe Biden today. Of course, tonight he gives his acceptance speech in the final night of the 2020 Democratic National Convention. Jack Beattie, On Point news analyst, is with us. And Jack, I just want to hover over 1987 for another moment here, because at the same on that same year, there was a very contentious Supreme Court confirmation hearing. And on the eighth day of the Senate hearings for Supreme Court nominee Robert Bork, that happened actually, this will be the same day that Joe Biden held a press conference announcing that he was pulling out of that 87 presidential race. So let's listen.
I have to choose between running for president and doing my job to keep the Supreme Court from moving in a direction that I believe to be truly harmful. There will be other opportunities for me to campaign for president, but there will not be many other opportunities for me to influence President Reagan's choice on the Supreme Court.
Now, of course, Jack, as we were talking about in the previous segment, Robert Bork wasn't the reason that Joe Biden pulled out of the presidential race that year, but in his handling of the Bork nomination, it really, or those confirmation hearings, it really changed. It was quite a historic moment for the Senate and the Supreme Court. And you wanted to talk about that.
Yes. You know, Jennifer mentioned how Joe Biden can say profound things sometimes. Well, talking to his buddies once in Delaware, he said, there's a river of power that flows through this country. Some people know about the river, but they can't get in. They only stand at the edge. And some people, a few, get to swim in the river all the time. They get to swim their whole lives, anywhere they want to go, always in the river of power. And that river flows from the Ivy League. Anyone who doesn't recognize the truth of that isn't conscious. Robert Bork taught constitutional law at the Ivy League at Yale. And he was a brilliant and iconoclastic jurist. He had been an appellate judge and scholar. And he criticized a range of Supreme Court decisions and seemed ready to overturn any number of them, from civil rights to abortion rights. And the question was, how are we going to defeat him? How does Joey Biden, the University of Delaware, and, you know, bottom of his class nearly at Syracuse Law, how does he stand up to the brilliant Robert Bork? Well, he figured out how. Instead of making his stand on Roe v. Wade, he went to what was behind Roe v. Wade, the Griswold decision of 1965, which conferred the right to privacy on married couples to use contraception. Strangely enough, in Connecticut, there was a law against it. And the court found that there was, in fact, a right to privacy in the Constitution, but it was not exactly an explicit right. And Justice Douglas said it springs from specific guarantees in the Bill of Rights that have penumbras formed by emanations from those guarantees. Penumbras formed by emanations. Well, of course, Robert Bork said, that's foolishness. That's stupid. You can't posit rights like that. And I would not have voted on Griswold. So Joe saw his opening. And he said, Judge, let me see if I get this straight. A man's at home in bed with his wife, and the police break in. And they look at him. They said, you can't do that. And the man says, but wait. There's a right of privacy in the Constitution. And the police say, no, there isn't. Judge Bork says there's no right to privacy. Am I right, Judge, that there's no right to privacy in the Constitution to protect a man and his wife in bed? And of course, Bork gives an academic answer on the one hand, on the other hand. And Joe, by putting this big idea into the language of ordinary people, brings out what a radical Judge Bork is, and really he wins the day. So just when he's been flattened, humiliated, made mock of because of the Kinnock business, he rises to the occasion. He picks himself up and he confronts Robert Bork, and the nomination is defeated. Ultimately, President Reagan nominates Anthony Kennedy, who goes on to be really one of the great heroes of jurisprudence regarding gay rights on the United States Supreme Court.
So Biden has that victory there with Robert Bork. But Jack, as you well know, I mean, this is the thing about having a long political career. It's all shades of gray, because for conservative legal scholars, that same moment has gone down in history as getting borked, right? They point to Joe Biden as the man who transformed Senate confirmation hearings for Supreme Court nominees from these affairs of exploration and decorum to sort of political witch hunts, because they saw Robert Bork as being eminently qualified for the high court, right? As you noted, he was a constitutional law scholar at Yale. He'd served as Solicitor General of the United States, acting Attorney General. He was qualified on paper as a legal scholar, and yet Joe Biden led the charge to fail his confirmation because of Bork's jurisprudence. And that forever changed Supreme Court confirmation hearings. And I don't think conservatives will ever let Biden forget about that.
Yes, but it's somewhat unfair, because at the end of the hearings, Biden said, Judge, have you been treated fairly? Do you think you have? And he said he had. And in fact, I heard the entire hearings. I was fascinated by it. He was treated fairly by Joe Biden. What the conservatives do is they're conflating Ted Kennedy's, over the top Senate rhetoric on the floor of the Senate about the danger of Bork. You know, women will be back in back alleys with coat hangers trying to get abortions. There'll be no blacks will be in the back of the bus because they can't have sex. Kennedy really went, full throttle on that. And that's sort of, I think, been laid on Joe. Joe didn't play it that way. In fact, he got Republican votes on the committee to back him up, at least one, Senator Specter, and that was an important one. And he got Southern conservatives to come along, too. So I think the Republicans, it's a sore spot, but it's wrongly aimed, that critique, at Joe Biden.
Well, let's move then to another period of Biden's political life. That has to do with the vice presidency, of course. So here's former President Barack Obama last night speaking at the Democratic National Convention, the virtual convention. He chose his location as the Museum of the American Revolution in Philadelphia. And here is what Obama said.
12 years ago, when I began my search for a vice president, I didn't know I'd end up finding a brother. Joe and I come from different places, different generations, but what I quickly came to admire about Joe Biden is his resilience, born of too much struggle, his empathy, born of too much grief, Joe is a man who learned early on to treat every person he meets with respect and dignity, living by the words his parents taught him. No one's better than you, Joe, but you're better than nobody.
Former President Barack Obama last night. Well, joining us now from Bethesda, Maryland is Stephen Levingston. He's author of Barack and Joe, The Making of an Extraordinary Partnership. He's also the nonfiction editor at The Washington Post. Stephen, welcome to the program.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
So how important is it to understand the relationship between Joe Biden and Barack Obama in terms of how that shaped Biden, you know, over the past 20 years?
Well, I think the relationship has really been, at least in this campaign, almost everything for Biden. The fact that he was by the side of the first black president for 8 years and served him wonderfully and dutifully and did everything that that Obama wished of him and did it well, as Obama just said in your clip there from the speech, it sort of showed that Biden is a man who gets things done. It also shows that he's a man who can push forward on racial issues. One thing about that relationship is that they worked so beautifully together, a black president and a white vice president, a younger black man who was very cerebral and an older white man who tend to spew words in all directions. But they sort of worked so beautifully together, and they didn't talk about that, really. They just sort of let their relationship show the people, how we as Americans should work together, black and white, and in leadership and in all possible ways.
Well, you know what? The thing about Joe Biden's career is that it's so long, and there's so much detail we could dig into. But since we're talking about Barack Obama's speech last night, Jack and Stephen, I wonder if we could just talk about some specific non-Joe Biden parts of it, because what President Obama said last night caught a lot of people off guard in terms of its forthrightness and its tone and its tenor and its warning, essentially. So first of all, here is a moment where President Obama, former President Obama, really didn't hold back in his criticism of President Donald Trump.
They know they can't win you over with their policies. So they're hoping to make it as hard as possible for you to vote and to convince you that your vote does not matter. That is how they win. That is how they get to keep making decisions that affect your life and the lives of the people you love. That's how the economy will keep getting skewed to the wealthy and well-connected. How our health systems will let more people fall through the cracks. That's how a democracy withers, until it's no democracy at all. And we cannot let that happen. Do not let them take away your power.
Stephen, what did you make of that?
I thought that speech was absolutely startling. I mean, especially coming from a man like Obama. Obama was Mr. Optimism, Mr. Hope to everybody in America when he was president, when he was running for president. That's basically what attracted everyone to him. So this kind of unheard of darkness and even despair that came from him as a kind of warning was really surprising. It's kind of like we've been waiting to hear what Obama would have to say about our current moment, about the past 3.5 years, and he's held back because he didn't think he should do this. Last night, he finally spoke up. And what I found really interesting about this is because I covered, you know, I wrote about his early life in my book, and I went back and I looked at his speech at the Democratic National Convention in 2004, that famous speech where he burst upon the world and everybody saw this beautiful, bright new light shining. That's where he established himself as Mr. Optimism and Mr. Hope, really. And in that speech, we sort of all remember what he said. He spoke with optimism and hope. And he said, there's not a liberal America and a conservative America. There's the United States of America. There's not a black America, a white America, a Latino America, an Asian America. There's the United States of America. And that was the dream that he was offering to America at the time. And then last night, if you fast forward to his speech last night, some of the things you didn't have in your clip there, he said, for close to 4 years now, Donald Trump has shown no interest in finding common ground. that common ground that he mentioned in his 2004 speech. In his speech, you know, he also outlined, you know, the basic American principles, how we work together, we have peaceful protests, we have a free speech, we have, you know, the fact that we're all just Americans.
But then, common values, exactly.
Common values. And then he said, these shouldn't be Republican principles or Democratic principles. They should be, they're American principles. But at this moment, this president and those who enable him have shown they don't believe in these things. And then finally later he said, this administration has shown it will tear down our democracy if that's what it takes to win. Now, the fact that Obama spoke in those terms and that language with that tone, it really makes the speech almost unrecognizable from the Obama we knew. And he sent this message, I think, that he meant to send, that we were basically at a moment of existential peril in this country.
Yeah, I mean, in my mind, it marks it as a historical speech for so many reasons. Because, Jack, the other thing is that presidents in speaking in conventions, former presidents in speaking in conventions, typically never do such pointed sort of not veiled attacks on the current occupant of the office. And yet, President Obama did exactly that by underscoring that he said, I have been there. I have felt the weight of that office. Mm. And yet, he was saying that he believes that Donald Trump doesn't take the weight of that office seriously. I mean, that break with tradition there, Jack, what did you make of it?
Well, I think Stephen says it very well. I mean, it was a dramatic break with tradition and with the President Obama's own worldview, which now looks poignantly naive. One nation, no blue, no red, no. Well, we know that's not true, and it started to be not true a long time ago. And with Trump, it's reached a kind of, you know, reductio ad absurdum. You can't imagine a president who's as threatening to democratic, to the continuance of democracy as this one. Just on that day, that same day, the president seemed to embrace the QAnon conspiracy theory, which is, the FBI has said it's a potential source of domestic terrorism. And so he is a menace to the continuance of our democracy, the president was saying. And if you don't think so, I don't know that people, I suppose his supporters don't think so. Conscious people think so. Those not in the Trump cult are just look at the paper and think so. And the president, and President Obama, I think, spoke for them and spoke out of the wounded conscience of the nation and said, enough.
Well, it's in that context that tonight Joe Biden will stand on stage and try to deliver, and he will deliver his speech, his nomination acceptance as the nominee for the Democratic Democratic presidential nominee. It'll be quite a moment. So Stephen Livingston, author of Barack and Joe, The Making of an Extraordinary Partnership, and nonfiction editor at The Washington Post, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Jack Beattie, On Point News Analyst, thank you as well, Jack.
Thank you, Magna.
I'm Magna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.